Okay, thanks for the invitation. And some of you might have got a draft of the paper, but for those who haven't, I will now give exposition of the ideas. Now, historically, there exists a position in just war theory that actually the combatants on the unjustified in a war, at least if they know that they are on the unjustified side of the war, are not allowed to participate in the war and cannot justly kill the combatants on the other side. This is very often misinterpreted, the history. Very often you hear people say that the idea of a moral equality of combatants, that is the idea that combatants on both the justified and the unjustified side are allowed to kill each other in a war, is actually the orthodox view. This is not the orthodox view at all, but it's constantly confused. Not only Suarez and Vitoria, but a couple of other authors explicitly denied that there's such an equality of war. And by the way, also Grotius did. And for reasons unknown to me, a lot of people think somehow that Grotius is the great founder of the moral equality of combatants. That's complete nonsense. But nonsense that's widely believed. Now, in recent times, the author who has perhaps done most to provide arguments why there's not a moral equality of combatants is Jeff McMahon. So in the second part of the talk, I will explicitly deal with some objections to my position Jeff has advanced. Now, let me start by giving the basics. So one argument, and this argument has actually also already been advanced in a way by Grotius, one argument is that there cannot be justified defense against a just or justified attack. So Jeff McMahon says that since, for example, a criminal is not allowed to defend himself against the justified attack or defensive attack maybe of a police officer, so also it's not clear why combatants on the unjustified side of a war should be allowed to defend themselves against the justified or just attacks of the combatants on the other side. Now, this is maybe intuitively quite plausible as long as we only consider the two involved combatants. But my argument is that once we consider bystanders, it's not that clear anymore at all, because also the so-called justified combatants or the combatants on the justified side will in most wars pose unjust threats to innocent bystanders. For example, the soldiers on the unjustified side might be engaged in a bombing raid against an ammunition factory, but a side effect of the attack on the ammunition factory would be the so-called collateral damage, or as I prefer to say, the concomitant slaughter of innocent bystanders. So they would actually pose an unjust threat to those innocent bystanders. And Jeff agrees. He says the rights of the innocent bystanders would be violated. And as given how he once formulated his position, it would actually logically follow that then these justified soldiers become liable to attack, because liability to attack consists, according to earlier formulations of Jeff's, consists in moral responsibility for posing an unjust threat, and they would pose an unjust threat. But he has then later on revised his theory as stating that justification defeats liability. So he now thinks that if the combatants on the justified side are, ex hypothesi, justified, they cannot be liable to attack. Just a side remark, that argument in itself could appear to be a little bit question-begging, because McMahon, if he wants to establish an inequality between the combatants, he must assume already that the combatants on the unjustified collective side, right, on the collective that wages an unjustified war, that the individual combatants cannot be justified in waging that war to for the, his argument to work. But this is a kind of what this whole issue is about. So it seems to be a sort of question begging to assume right away that combatants on the unjustified collective side cannot be justified. It might sound crazy. How can somebody who's fighting on an unjustified side be justified? But it's actually not crazy at all. My standard example that I give, and some people said I should revise it with consideration to Texans, but I will not revise it now. My standard example is... suppose you go through the street of Berlin somewhere, and there's a group, a group of neo-Nazis in the process of bashing some foreigners to death, right? And you pass by, and you say you cannot do any. You see, you cannot do anything about it. If you would personally intervene, all that would happen is you would be killed by the neo-Nazis. However, there happens to be a group of Texans nearby, Texan tourists. And, you know, they would get the job done. So you could go up to them and tell them, you know, help me in saving the innocent bystanders from the bad neo-Nazis. And the Texans tell you, no problem, but you know we are Texans. When we engage in violence, it's always excessive. And second, we won't do it without you, you know, so that you not later on complain about our excessive violence from the sidelines. And so in this occasion, all you can do is either do nothing and let the innocent people be killed by the neo-Nazis, or you can join the Texans. However, since they would, ex hypothesi, be involved in excessive violence, this collective violence would be unjustified because it's excessive, right? But your personal participation would be justified because it's a lesser evil. So it is quite, and I mean, this is true for a lot of contexts. It has not just to do with context of violence, but this is just a general rule that participation in an unjustified collective act is not automatically unjustified on the individual level. Okay, now... My argument has now been, as I pointed out, that the combatants on the unjustified on the justified side would pose an unjust threat. Let me now say a little bit, maybe, about liability to attack in general. I follow to a certain degree Judith Jarvis Thompson's account, who Judith Jarvis Thompson has argued that you become, she doesn't use the term liable, but she says that you can forfeit your right not to be attacked by violating the rights of other people. So if the unjust attacker violates the rights of other persons, then he becomes liable to attack. She, however, thinks also that so-called innocent attackers or innocent threats can be, I just use the term now, be liable to attack. An innocent attacker would be somebody who has taken drugs, unbeknownst to him, has taken drugs, and this now, causes a psychotic break or something, and therefore he's attacking unjustly another person. And there already a certain doubt would appear whether somebody who is not really a responsible actor can actually violate another person's right. But still, stronger doubts would appear if you have a so-called innocent threat, like Robert Nozick's famous falling man. There's a falling fat man, he falls from some cliff, and he's about to crush an innocent bystander below. And in most jurisdictions in the world, the innocent bystander below would actually be justified in using defensive measures. For example, if he has some kind of ray gun, he could vaporize the falling man in order to save his or her own life. In most jurisdictions, this would be clearly justified, and most people think that it's also from a moral point of view plausible to think that that is justified. However, the crux here is that many people think that you can only violate rights by actions. You wouldn't say of a falling boulder that he violates, or that the boulder violates a person's right, and people then think you cannot say of a falling man, if he's not acting but just falling, something is happening to the man actually, that this man violates a person's right. And this is where then I find this criticism quite convincing, actually, just semantically quite convincing. and here part just ways with Thompson and say that you can not only become liable to attack by violating another person's right, but also by posing an unjust threat to that person's right. An unjust threat here means that one does not have a right to pose the threat one is posing, and the thing that is posing the threat has not been set in motion by someone who had a right to do so. So the falling man does not have a right, you know, to crush the person below, which is pretty much obvious. If you could just deflect that person, that would clearly be allowed. And in this situation, you have a clash of rights. What is, in my view, very often overlooked by philosophers like Jeff McMahon or also David Rodin is they say, oh, you cannot just lose a right by not doing anything. You have to do something in order to lose a right, you know? And then they say, oh, the poor falling man, he hasn't done anything, and therefore he cannot have lost his right to life and his claim right to self-defense. But on the other hand, then the poor man standing below is forgotten. This man has also done nothing to lose his right to life or his right to self-defense. And my view is that in this situation, in where you have a clash of rights, of general rights to self-defense, so to say, they cannot coexist anymore as rights. That would be a logical contradiction, and they transfer themselves into liberties. I explain in a second what that is. And liberties can coexist with each other. To give you an everyday example, I mean, the terminology I use here is a Hofeldian. Wesley N. Hofeld has coined this terminology. It is a Hofeldian terminology, and Hofeld distinguishes between claim rights, and unless otherwise stated, when I say right, I always mean claim rights. So he distinguishes between claim rights on the one hand and liberty rights on the other. Now, if I have a claim right to do something, that means that other persons have a duty not to interfere in my exercising this right. So if I have a claim right, you know, to get this glass of water, then other persons are not allowed to interfere in my action. And if I have a claim right to hit another person, for example, to kill another person, this would imply that this other person is under duty not to interfere, right? But of course, you can have clearly situations where I am under, have a liberty to hit a person, right? That is, means I am not under duty not to hit a person, while the other person still retains her liberty to hit me back or to interfere. The common situation would be the example of two boxers. They don't have claim rights against each other to hit each other because claim rights are not compatible, logically, but they have liberties. So both of them don't violate a duty by hitting the other person, and they don't violate a duty by trying the other person from keeping them from hitting them. So liberties are just different. And a couple of people somehow claim that this is not consistent, but in my view, this is not only consistent, it's actually an analytical truth if you apply the terminology of Wesley Hofeld, which I simply do. I just wanted to make this clear because sometimes there is a problem that these distinctions between liberty and claim rights are very often forgotten, and then people talk about rights and see inconsistencies because they just don't make the distinction between claim rights and liberty rights, or sometimes they use the term rights for a claim right and sometimes it's liberty rights, and these confusions should be avoided. Now, how do people in a justified war violate the rights of others? Well, one thing is, of course, I mentioned it already, by directly killing innocent bystanders. And, of course, collateral damage is still directly killing. It would only be indirect. These examples are sometimes given by Tony Godey. You could perhaps say an indirect killing is if I bop a drum on the ammunition factory, and then the bomb makes the wall fall, of the ammunition factory and the wall falls on the on an innocent bystander, that is maybe indirect killing. But dropping a bomb on persons and these bomb shredding the persons to pieces is certainly a form of direct killing, right? So one thing you can do is killing person directly, although it might be collaterally, but that is still direct. And you might directly impose also risks on them of being killed in this way. But this has been pointed out by Seth Lazar and others, also by Jeff actually, and one idea is that not all combatants on the justified side, and by the way on the unjustified side either, are actually posing threats in this way to innocent bystanders. A lot of them will at best contribute to posing threats. And in my view, it is important to see that this can be quite sufficient. Let me give you an example outside of the war context. Let's say the Jekyll, you know, this famous killer of the novel, the Jekyll wants to kill an innocent bystander. And there's Alex somewhere who has to mark the victim or the target for the Jekyll so that the Jekyll knows whom he has to kill. And he's doing that. In that case, you know, jurisdictions in most Western countries, actually, so far as I know, in all Western countries, would say that this is participation in a crime. So the person who marks the target for the Jekyll would participate in this crime of killing the innocent bystander. However, it is not necessary that he causally contributes. So even, for example, if it's not, if actually, you know, there was no causal necessity for him to put this mark, and even actually if the Jekyll might not even have seen this mark, the accomplice put on the target, he would still be considered as a participant. You see this from bank robberies. You know, if somebody is standing outside and watching out for the police coming, even if that in the end has not played a causal role and the robbery might have gone along anyway, he would still be held liable in most jurisdictions as somebody who participated in the bank robbery. So this is just to deflate Seth Lazar's and others' worry that that too few people would be actually liable to attack. I think that's not necessary if you take accomplices into account. This is participation. Another thing is what I call culpable contribution. For example, if somebody, full well knowing that the Jekyll wants to kill an innocent person, sells the Jekyll a weapon to do it, that would be in most jurisdictions clearly a culpable contribution. It would not necessarily be considered participation. That depends a little bit on the jurisdictions. But I make this distinction between direct participation and culpable contribution. And then you have, you know, innocent contribution. And two examples would be, you know, a woman, a restaurant owner or cook, full well knowing that the Jekyll is out to kill somebody, cooks a meal for the Jekyll. She has not the possibilities to call the police or anything. All she's doing is she's cooking him a meal and he goes out and kills somebody. Now, she would not be liable in Western jurisdictions as in participation of a crime. And if somebody, the son of this woman, sold the Jekyll ammunition without knowing that the Jekyll is somebody who uses to kill innocent person, or that there's a high probability that he might do so, would also be innocent in Western jurisdictions. And you can transform this, or you can apply these distinctions reasonably well to the war situation. You have people who directly kill innocent persons, then you have people who participate in the collective effort, in a collective war effort that kills innocent persons by, for example, maintaining the weaponry. This would be the analogy maybe of marking the target for the Jekyll. And then you have persons who culpably contribute by providing the weaponry, full well knowing what will happen with it. And you have then persons who are not responsible at all because they just, you know, provide food for the army. There might be some city, well, Cecil Faber, for example, would say that there are ways of providing food to the army that might make them liable to attack, and I actually agree. But in my view, there are also ways of providing food for the army that would not make them liable to attack. And there can be people, you know, like the Guatemaltecan, that's my example, the Guatemaltecan screw producer, some worker in a fabric or in a factory who produces screws, full well knowing that they might be used. There is a certain possibility that they might be used. Well, Gaddafi is dead now, but at that time, Gaddafi was my example, might be used by Gaddafi's troop to fight, you know, the revolution. And on McMahon's account, and it's very difficult for him to get out of this, it seems on McMahon's account, it would be this screw producer would be liable to attack if there is a chance that by attacking him, you might further the just causes, let's say, of the revolution, right? But on my account, which I think is more plausible, intuitively more plausible, this person is not yet liable to attack. The distance is just too big. This is a basic outline maybe of liability to attack. And note that I've not really tried to give specific criteria what distinguishes participation from culpable contribution. I think this is really very difficult, but it's also not necessarily done in case law. So I don't think you need for everything clear criteria. It seems to be impossible, for example, to give you a definition or to give you clear criteria. How do I distinguish green from red? You just cannot write a definition, but most people can distinguish green from red. And as long as they do so, then rules that rely on this distinction can work. Like, you know, you are allowed to walk if it's green and you have to stand still if it's red. I don't have to define it. As long as people know the difference, that's good enough. Of course, I don't deny that there are gray zones where you don't exactly know if it's still red or if it's already green or something, or it's still participation or if it's already something less like culpable contribution, but I think the distinctions work well enough without having, you know, completely clear-cut criteria. Okay, now Jeff has advanced several objections to this, and I will not actually go through all these objections. His most important objection is that justification defeats liability. Right, and I had early on pointed out that that seems to me to be an ad hoc claim. Why does justification defeat liability? And then Jeff said, well, it does so in criminal law, right? So if you're justified, then you are not liable to punishment. That's true, but it's also beside the point, which Jeff actually acknowledges, because that's not what we are talking about. We are not talking about liability to punishment, but liability to defensive attack. And it's clearly, and Jeff admits this now, it's clearly not the case that in the law justification generally defeats liability. For example, he now says that, for example, the tactical bomber who bombs the ammunition factories, full well knowing that this will also kill innocent bystanders, is allowed to do this, allowed to kill the innocent bystanders under a necessity defense, right? And necessity defenses you have in law. But necessity defenses in law are the paradigm example for justifications. The necessity defense is, in most jurisdictions, a justification. They are a paradigm example for a justification that does not defeat liability. This is shown by the fact that, for example, somebody who has a necessity defense, for example, to break in somebody else's house, maybe he's dying, he's about to have a heart attack, and he knows in this other person's house there's a medicine that can save him, then he would in many jurisdictions have a necessity defense to break in. So he would be justified under the law to do this, and he would not be punished. However, he would be still liable to pay the person whose right he has violated, namely the owner of a house, compensation. So he's still liable to do that. In light of this, Jeff has then backed off and claimed, I admit justification in law does not defeat liability, but justification does defeat liability to defensive attack, right? But that's now completely ad hoc. You know, he could have claimed, oh, my former argument was not ad hoc because I had the general argument that justification defeats liability. Now, I point out, no, it doesn't. And then Jeff says, well, but at least it does in the case of liability to defensive attack or defensive killing. But that's, of course, precisely the issue in question. Whether it does or whether it does not, to just claim it does is not sufficient. One would need an argument to show that it does. And I don't see any argument. On the contrary, if you look, and I won't go to the legal debates now that would lead too far, but in US American law, it seems really to be, at least you can make a very, very strong argument. It seems to be the case if, for example, you take the model penal code into account, whose rendering of necessity defenses has also been adopted by some US states. If you take the model legal code into account, it's clear that you can, for example, have a necessity defense to kill persons, right? But the model penal code claims that you would still be liable at least to pay compensation. Maybe for the people, for the children or the kin of the person you killed, for wrongful death, right? And in addition, legal scholar called Christie, he makes the argument that he does not see any American court who would claim that somebody who defends himself against this attacker who has a necessity defense to attack you, he says he cannot see any court in the U.S. saying that the attacker would have to pay compensation to the children that the defender, I mean the innocent person, would have to pay compensation to the children of the attacker in case that he can actually defend himself against the attacker successfully by killing him. So the idea is, according to Christie, that you have a moral asymmetry or legal asymmetry in this case in place. And this would be precisely how McMahon, at least more recently, defines liability. So if there is a symmetry, if the justified attacker can be killed justly by the defender, then while the other way around, the person who has a necessity defense cannot kill the person towards which he's using this necessity defense justly, then you again have this kind of moral asymmetry that would show that one person is liable and the other person is not. So the point that justification defeats liability is just not particularly plausible. And by the way, also apart from the legal side, not shared by too many philosophers. I mean, Friends of Camus, for example, is very clear about the fact that justification does not defeat liability in this way. Now, Jeff has tried to cause me problems with alleged counterintuitive implications my account would have. I will not go through this because I think Jeff, in order to ascribe these implications to me, has to ascribe assumptions to me I simply do not make. And second, some of the arguments rely on the confusion between liberty rights and claim rights. Quite frankly, it's very complicated, and I'm not sure that you can really orally explain this well. I think you have to see this in writing. So at the moment, well, you don't have to take my word for it, but I think the implications, charging me with counterintuitive implications, does not really work. On the other hand, I cannot resist to point out that Jeff's own position, that liability to attack lies in being morally responsible for an unjustified threat. The moral responsibility for an unjustified threat comes with certain counterintuitive assumptions. He gives himself one example, and he doesn't really, you know, solve the problem. He's honest and states that's really a problem, and he's now trying actually to move on. But he's in between. He has not yet provided an account that would solve the problem. And the problem is this. He says, well, suppose there is a mother, for example, and a mother can, she's giving birth. And of course, there's a reasonable chance, there is some chance at least, foreseeable chance that your son or daughter might turn out to be a killer and unjustly kill some person, right? And on his accounts, it would, in his account as it's formulated, would actually follow that in a situation where now this danger materializes and the son is about to kill an innocent bystander, this innocent bystander would allow it to save her own life by somehow using the mother. For example, if in that situation, 20 years after giving birth, he would the attacked person would be able to defend herself or to avert the threat of the son by killing the mother, he would be allowed to do that. And Jeff admits that's counterintuitive, and I agree, it's completely counterintuitive. While my account, where you know you become liable to attack by posing an unjust threat to another person in the way I have described, and the obvious way, would, the most obvious way would be by violating the other person's right, can deal with this problem. I mean, the problem doesn't even arise because the mother, by giving birth, doesn't violate anybody's rights at all. And when the son finally attacks somebody, she's also not violating anybody's rights. The son is doing it, right? So I don't have this problem, and Jeff tries now to fix it somehow. But my, to be honest, my prediction is that he cannot solve this problem without really completely revising his whole account. And I'm not sure how much would be kept of it. And what's more important, I have somehow the feeling, I might be wrong, that it would be very close to the accounts of rights violations I have stated, with modifications. I mean, he doesn't like an account of rights violations or an account of liability where innocent threats or innocent attackers could also be killed. But he could prevent this. But on the side where you have only rights violations, I would somehow anticipate that there wouldn't be a great difference between his account and mine. Okay, so far, so good. Let me... Well, I think I should actually come to the end. Let me say what all this implies and does not apply. Now, I have here said that you can make the argument that due to the fact that the soldiers on the unjustified in most modern wars are posing unjust threats to innocent bystanders, they are liable to attack. And liable to attack in this sense means that the combatants on the unjustified side could kill them without wronging them. Right? So if they kill them, they have not violated their right. That's what liability means, as Jeff and others use the term. So if somebody is liable to attack, you can attack this person without violating the person's right. Now, from this itself, it doesn't follow that's permissible to attack the person. There's a difference. And the difference is a little bit the mirror side of a distinction that is sometimes made the other way around. For example, with the necessity defense. The necessity defense basically states that you can, under certain circumstances, violate a person's right and be justified in doing it, right? But you can also have, that's now not necessity justifications, but that's what I say, you can also have the contrary position, namely that you can have situations where you could do something, for example, hurt a person without violating the person's right, but still not be permitted in doing it. And examples are obvious. You know, if, let's say if somebody attacks me and, you know, tries to slap me, then I would normally be justified, not only justified, he would become liable to my counterattack. So if I could stop him by slapping him first, I would be not only allowed to do it, but it would be just, right? So I wouldn't, the person couldn't complain about it. Now suppose that I know that if I would react in this way to the attack of this person who's trying to slap me, I know that if that happens, a supervillain will blow up a kindergarten, to take the extreme example. Under this circumstance, it seems to me that I would not be permitted in defending myself against the attacker. If I do defend myself, well, I don't wrong him because he's an unjust attacker. But of course, I have to take the bigger picture into account, and the bigger picture is, saving myself a slap on the face is not so important that I should allow a kindergarten to be blown up. So my argument that you have these equal liberty rights of combatants on both sides in modern wars does not imply, this facile conclusion that you can happily now take part in every war. It only makes, the decisions you have to make somewhat more difficult. By the way, and this is kind of important for me because it seems to be constantly overlooked. By the way, on the other hand, that you can the fact that soldiers on the so-called justified side can kill combatants on the unjustified side justly does also not necessarily mean that they are permitted to do it. Well, the obvious example would be, again, the kindergarten example, but just blown into bigger dimensions, the stake of humanity, the survival of humanity is at stake, or something like this. If the just soldiers justified soldiers would actually attack the unjustified soldiers, something terrible would happen, the planet would blow up. But even if you forget about, that's just to show the conceptual possibility, but even if you forget about this, I think very often if you look at humanitarian interventions, of course, you save a lot of lives, maybe, if you engage in a humanitarian intervention. But these interventions cost really, really a lot of money, right? And the question is, could you not use this lot of money better? So if by your humanitarian intervention you save, you spend X amount of money, X money units, and you save with your war maybe 30,000 people from genocide, but you could, with these X money units, if you give it to Oxfam, save 2 million people from starving. It is not that clear to me that you are permitted in taking part in the justified war. So, by the way, this seems to me also a certain kind of indication that justifying humanitarian wars might be more difficult than many people assume. But that I really want to make clear that I'm not trying to fall back on some kind of Walserian position. My argument is very much different from Walzer's argument. Walzer basically, first, I don't think his argument is a justification, and Jeff has really pointed this very clearly out, that Walzer's argument cannot reasonably read as a justification of the soldiers on the unjustified side for killing the soldiers on the justified side. There's some kind of general tendency of just excusing the soldiers and say it's okay to just follow the orders, right? And I disagree with this. I don't think it's just okay to follow orders on the unjustified side, nor do I agree that it's just okay to follow orders on the justified side. And of course, my argument does not deny the principal point Jeff McMahon and others before him are making, namely that there's not this general moral equality of combatants. For example, you could have wars where one side is invading another side's country and unjustly, and the justified defenders are not actually posing unjust threats to anybody. You could make an argument, well, they are still posing unjust threats to their own innocence, right? But actually you have an argument against this where you can use McMahon's own recent article of McMahon about the just distribution of harms between combatants and non-combatants. For example, if, so to say, the defenders are defending the invaded country on behalf of their own citizens, and maybe with the consent of their own citizens, then it seems to me that even if their defensive actions also endanger their own citizens in concrete maneuvers and concrete tactics, would not do an injustice to these citizens. So my point is that in principle the argument is correct. You don't have a general moral equality of combatants. However, McMahon and others really greatly exaggerate the scope of the argument, since in most modern wars, and in most wars generally, probably the soldiers on the unjust, on the justified side, pose unjust threats to innocent bystanders. They are also liable to attack. Okay, thank you.